Let's go out to the ball game, boys.
What yeah, that's good idea. Idea. Boy, that's good idea.
Welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists on books, movies, DVDs, collectibles, pretty much anything to do with the national pastime. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, the podcast edition. I'm your host, Ron Kaplan, and one of my New Year's resolutions is to bring you these podcasts on a much more regular basis. There are a lot of really good books coming out in 2012, and I know the authors will be thrilled to talk about their projects, their processes, and their plans for future events, whether they're speaking at a local bookstore or appearing on other forms of media. I thought I'd take a moment and give a nod to this year's awards season. The Golden Globes were handed out recently. We have the Screen Actors Guild and the Oscars coming up in the near future. And they're not the only ones handing out the awards this year. The Casey Award is handed out by Spitball Magazine, which is celebrating their 30th anniversary this year. It's a magazine dedicated to poetry, short fiction, prose, art, and book reviews. And you can visit them at spitballmag.com. Well, they've been handing out the Casey Award, which goes to what they believe is the best baseball book each year. They've been doing that since 1983. There have been some pretty big names who have received the awards, including Joe Posnanski, Howard Bryant, Lee Montville, Bill James, and Michael Lewis, who's book Moneyball, of course, has been turned into a movie and is up for 6 Academy Awards this year. So I thought it would be appropriate to talk to this year's recipient. Kostya Kennedy was named to receive the coveted prize for 56, Joe DiMaggio and the Last Magic Number in Sports. And he will pick up the award in March in Cincinnati, which is the home base for Spitball at the annual award luncheon. And if you're interested in attending or just want to find out more about the Casey Award or Spitball or the luncheon, go ahead and visit the spitballmag.com website. And now, without further ado, is the Bookshelf Conversation with Kostya Kennedy.
So congratulations on the Casey Award.
Thanks very much.
Were you aware of this award before you received it? Because it's not one of the higher profile pieces of hardware.
I was aware of it. You know, I think that, I think what you're saying is probably right, although I think that people in the community, those of us who, you know, write about sports and care about baseball in this kind of way, knew about it. I've been reading Spitball since I was a kid, so forever, basically, and so I was definitely aware of the award, and, you know, aware that some of the people who've gotten it and all that. So
very prestigious company.
Yeah, for me personally, it meant a lot, you know, to be in this group with these people. And as I say, like, it is, you know, it's something that I respected, just being in the game with some of these people. It is something that you're aware of. So, yeah, and it's pleasing and it's humbling and it's wonderful to, for me, it's a wonderful thing.
Now, when did you decide you were going to write a book about DiMaggio?
You know, I think that probably the seeds of this idea probably go as far back as being in the stand on September 5th, I think it was, 1995, and watching Cal Ripken tie, and then I was there the next night when he broke Lou Gehrig's record. And I didn't get started working on this book until more than a decade later. But I, there was something about that night and hearkening back to, they showed him into the Lou Gehrig on the screen and all that, that stayed with me. And then the steroid era came, and maybe it hasn't gone yet, but it came and left its mark. And it, through all that, and we saw these kind of records falling, of course, you know, these what I would call magic numbers that you grew up looking at, 714, for Aaron, for Ruth, I'm sorry, and 755 for Aaron, and 61 and 60, and of course, Ripken's number before that. And they were all gone, and the home run numbers were gone in this kind of polluted way. And I felt, you know, well, what was there? What number, you know, what achievement is there that you could walk into a room of baseball fans and just say the number and they're going to know? And that was like my first thought of it. Like, you can go in and say two and nobody's going to think of Johnny Vandermeer's no-hitters. But if you say 56, people know what you're talking about. So that was like kind of a little idea. I was thinking maybe it might be a little piece for Sports Illustrated or something like that. And then the more and more I looked into it and saw, you know, just what time it was, of course, in the country, and also to be able to see DiMaggio sort of stripped of Marilyn and stripped of Mr. Coffee and all the other stuff, which is interesting stuff and valuable stuff for people to learn about, but just to see him at age 26 when he was Joe DiMaggio, baseball star and not yet an icon, and to see him in this event that really turned him from being that star to being an icon, so basically, the more and more I looked into it, the more and more I thought, you know, there's a story to be told here, and there's a way to tell it, and it was both rooted in the time in 1941 in America and DiMaggio, and also in today, the fact that it was still, I mean, seriously, Ron, I would walk into the locker rooms and everybody knew it, you know, I mean, and everybody wanted to kind of talk about, oh, well, come over and say, I had a hitting streak once in college, you know, 28 games or whatever, and it still sort of had a hold in baseball circles, and that appealed to me a great deal.
Now, the fact that it came out last year, which was the 70th anniversary of the streak, one of the things I thought of was that there are still people around who remember seeing him as a player, but... Mm-hmm. As years go by, there are fewer and fewer of them, and
right.
This is a nice nostalgic look for them to remember back what they were like as kids and their impressions of seeing their hero.
Right. No, that's an excellent point. And as you say, there are fewer people who remember watching Joe, and even fewer who remember seeing him in 1941. Some people, you know, remember him from toward the tail end of his career, 49, 50, and such. There were a handful of people left. I was able to speak to Dom DiMaggio at length, and he was remarkably gracious with me what turned out to be a difficult time in his life. Bob Feller and some other major leaguers from that time. And the people I spoke to, many of them were young, and some of the book takes place sort of in a neighborhood in Queens, where there were kids there who were really, one of the kids went on to be the Yankees bat boy, but they were sort of really, they were Yankee fans, and they were just kind of kids of 15, you know, 14, 15, 16, playing stickball in the street, you know, going to get their soda, wanting to play softball on the weekends, all of that, in these sort of sports gangs that were part of the time. I say gang, meaning completely nonviolent. They just played from one neighborhood to another, and they played stickball, football, whatever they played. When I spoke to people like that and seeing, like, how much they would come alive remembering that summer, you know, it was really the way all of us, I guess, remember things from that special time in our lives when we're at that age and there's a certain freedom. And that really brought it alive to me a lot. It really, really made it come to feel palpable and all that, because people had really clear memories of this, although they were generally in their 80s, and they'd have sort of a very crisp recollection. As I said, I used that sort of neighborhood in Queens as a stand-in, but I also spoke to people in Newark and San Francisco and really all over, anybody I could get my hands on, and so they helped bring it alive.
Now, what were some of the sources you used for your research?
Well, a lot of these interviews, as I'm talking to you, as I've just been mentioning, so I spoke to a couple hundred of people, a lot of these people, as I just mentioned, and also major leaguers today, because part of the book talks about, you know, sort of how hard it would be today and what makes it difficult and the psychological effects and all that. So lots of major leaguers. But, you know, hitters, I spoke to Boggs and Gwynn, and basically if you were a hitter with a long streak or something, I spoke to you, Brett. and they were very informative and really great with their time as well. Of course, there were 9 or 11 papers covering the Yankees every single day then, so there was a lot of library research and, of course, magazines, books, really anything I could get my hands on.
Now, you mentioned about the papers. It's interesting. One of the fascinating parts of the book is that the way you're able to build a sense of suspense as the season goes along, and the way that people would wait for any little bit of news that they could hear. It's not like today where, you know, you get breaking news running across the bottom of your television or pumping in on the radio. You had to wait. If a game was played west of New York and there was a time delay, granted there weren't many night games at that point, but you had to wait until the next day to find out what was going on.
Right. No, that's an excellent point. And there's a couple things about that. One is sometimes you have to wait till the next day, but there was also the evening paper. A lot of times there'd be a day game. Games were shorter then because no TV. And so at 7 o'clock or whenever it was, your paper would come landing at the candy store at 7 o'clock in the evening, and people would run down to take a look at it and see what DiMaggio had done. And the waiting for it created suspense, no question, and it was also a more sense of community, I think, in the way news, not just in the case of DiMaggio, but in general, in the way news was consumed and gathered. So you went together and somebody pulled out the paper and everybody kind of crowded around and looked at it, or you got a couple of papers, or even if you were listening to radio, it tended to be a radio out and people would come collect on the stoop or outside a window and listen to it. It's not today, I think we get most of the information we get sort of privately. We're in our home office or in our office at work or wherever it is, and we're looking at something across a screen or a television screen. And so it changed the nature of that, and I think that it made people feel a little more invested in events, and certainly in this event at that time when it was a very heightened time in the country with World War II having begun and America's entrance into it seeming imminent, paying attention to news and what was going on was a really major part of people's everyday lives across a huge cross-section of society, and DiMaggio fell right into that, and it was part of what I think made this, gave it the drama that it did. It came at a time when there was a lot of consumption of news, and his story became the biggest story going for several weeks there.
Now, as a professional writer, athletes are always talking about what it might be like if either the players from the past were playing now or what they would be doing playing in the past. As a professional writer, how do you think your situation would have been different had you been writing in those times?
You mean if I'd been in 1941
right.
writing?
Right.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think that in some ways you had greater access. You had much greater access to players. Say if you're writing about sports, people didn't have handlers. I mean, they had their sort of little entourage. If you were a player like DiMaggio, you had some people who you kept around you. But often it was like Lefty Gomez, you know, just another player. There wasn't these sort of walls of insulation to get through. That said, there was sort of an unspoken thing. Certain things just weren't written about or weren't discussed. Personal things or just, you know, things didn't really go off the field as much as they might have. So I think it would have been hard to break out of that because that was completely the norm. It would have been a difficult thing. And I think also, of course, I tried in the book writing it today to, as you alluded to create a sense of suspense, really just trying to mirror what the actual experience was like in 1941. So you didn't know it was going to stop at 56. I mean, game 57 wasn't particularly important at that time, whereas game 40 really was, because he was going after George Sisler's record. So I think that to have that long view changed everything, changed the perception of it, and gave it a sort of sense, a weight, simply the fact that the events of that summer are still being talked about all these decades later. Add something to it by nature, implicitly. You don't even have to say it. It's there. Whereas if you're living through it, it probably would have been just a greater sense of excitement, a greater sense of amazement. Ted Williams that year, of course, hit over 400, and that has held up, and nobody's done that. But at the time, William, people had hit 400 before. 424 in the 20s, and nobody had gone on a hitting streak like this before. So it was really a new phenomenon for writers and observers to kind of get their hands around. So I think that would have been definitely been a challenge to sort of put it into perspective as best you could.
And do you think that DiMaggio's record will be broken one day?
I don't. So what I say about this, Ron, I think it's like the most unbreakable of the breakable records. By that I mean you only have to go 1-for-4. So it's not like, say, Cy Young 511 wins, which nobody's going to break that. I just put that in a sort of cartoon character. Or one of my favorites is Connie Mack, you know, who lost 3,800 games. Like, who's going to lose 3,800 games as a manager? Nobody. But to go on a hitting streak, it's doable. And there's no particular reason why somebody couldn't. Yet, the more you look into it and see how difficult it really is, the more I think that, no, nobody will break that record.
The book comes out in paperback this year?
Yes, it does. Thanks for asking. It comes out March 13th. So it's just a little less than 2 months away.
And we've been talking with Costa Kennedy, author of 56, Joe DiMaggio, and The Last Magic Number in Sports, who has been selected as the winner of the Casey Award from Spitball Magazine. Costa, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Ron, terrific talking with you. Thanks very much.
And that was our discussion with Costa Kennedy, winner of this year's Casey Award, as handed down by Spitball Magazine. Well, that brings us to the end of this podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you have some ideas about authors or artists or other people involved in baseball media that you'd like to hear talk about their work, please send me an email at ron@ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com. And don't forget, these podcasts are available to download via iTunes. Thanks very much, and have a great week.
Here comes.